Now that I'm reading Sri Aurobindo's wonderful poem, Savitri, I think it's a good idea to tell the whole story very briefly. This way people can follow what is going on in the book because they will know what part of the book it's in. And also, people can read any canto or any book, and they'll have a context. They can actually place the story, and then they can read what Sri Aurobindo has to say. The mother told the ashramites not to try to explain what Sri Aurobindo wrote. She said that they were not developed enough to understand Savitri fully. She told them that the best thing to do if they wanted to explain Savitri, was to use other things that Sri Aurobindo wrote on the same subject that they were reading in Savitri itself. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what Sri Aurobindo said about his writing of Savitri. When I tell you anything about the book, I'll quote from something that Sri Aurobindo wrote, and I'll also tell you what the source is. And with the story itself, I'm going to tell a story using quotations from Savitri as much as possible, just adding a sentence here and there to keep the line of the story going or to make some kind of transition. In order to keep the flow going, I won't say it's a quote, but I think you'll be able to know when it's I who am adding a sentence or two. The mother told people that they should read even if they felt they could not understand. In her classes to the ashram school students, she told them that each time they read the same thing, they would understand it better. And this is the experience that I have when I read Mother and Sri Aurobindo, and the experience that all my friends have also. Mother also told the students that when someone wrote a book, their essence went into the book and remained there. And if we read the book, we can come into contact with the presence of the writer. Sri Aurobindo started writing Savitri in August of 1916. The very first manuscript dated is on the second page, 8-9 August 1916. This is when he started. He continued to work on it over the years until he left in 1950. Although there were long spaces of time when he did not work on it. In one letter, Sri Aurobindo wrote about how he was writing Savitri. I may describe it as an infinite capacity for waiting and listening for the true inspiration and rejecting all that fell short of it, however good it might seem from a lower standard, until I got that which I felt to be absolutely right. In 1933, someone asked him how he wrote Savitri, and he said, "There is no invariable how, except that I receive from above my head and receive changes and corrections from above without any initiation by myself or labor of the brain." In 1936, he said, "In fact, Savitri has not been regarded by me as a poem to be written and finished, but as a field of experimentation to see how far poetry could be written from one's own consciousness and how that could be made creative." Sri Aurobindo kept rewriting and revising Savitri as his own yoga practice progressed, and he wrote about things which he himself realized along the way. In 1936, he wrote to someone, "I used Savitri as a means of ascension. I began with it on a certain mental level. Each time I could reach a higher level, I rewrote it from that level." In 1937, he wrote that he'd reached the end of the life worlds in Savitri and said that until he got mind in order and realized, or rather embodied, the psychic, he couldn't show any more of his work. In 1947, he said, "I have not, in Savitri, written anything for the sake of mere picturesqueness or merely to produce a rhetorical effect. What I am trying to do in the poem is to express something seen, something felt, or experienced. In the preface to Savitri, Sri Aurobindo gave us these descriptions. Savitri is the divine word, the daughter of the sun, goddess of the supreme truth who comes down. She is born to save. Savitri is represented in the poem as an incarnation of the divine mother. Savitri's human father, Ashwapati, is the lord of tapasya, which is the concentrated energy of spiritual endeavor that helps us to rise from the mortal to the immortal planes. Satyavan, Savitri's husband, who she rescues from death, is the soul carrying the truth within himself, but he is descended into the grip of death and ignorance. Sri Aurobindo says that the characters in his poem are incarnations, or emanations of living and conscious forces. They take human bodies to help man and to show him the way to a divine consciousness and immortal life. And we can enter into concrete touch with them. Today I'm going to start with the first half of Savitri. It's part one, the first three books, and it covers just about half of the whole volume. We are stopping right after the king has obtained the Divine Mother's promise to come down to earth and just before the birth of Savitri. Sri Aurobindo starts his story in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, but in fact, he brings us right away far into the story, because the story opens on the day that Satyavan, Savitri's husband, is going to die, and that occurs in Book 8, the Book of Death. As our story opens, Princess Savitri awakens to a beautiful sunrise, a bright new day. And slowly, gradually, as she wakes, she remembers what day it is. Her soul arose, confronting time and fate. Immobile in herself, she gathered force. This was the day that Satyavan must die. The long foreknown and fatal morn was here, bringing a noon that seemed like every other noon. No cry broke from her lips, no call for aid. She told the secret of her woe to none. She had been married to Satyavan for 1 year, living with him and his parents, and her 1 year in the great and lonely forest had helped to prepare her for the great task of conquering death, which she had taken birth to do. In the progress of her life, as Sri Aurobindo writes, love came to her, hiding the shadow death. All in her pointed to a nobler kind. Her look, her smile, awoke celestial sense even in earth stuff, and their intense delight poured a supernal beauty on men's lives. Love in her was wider than the universe. The whole world could take refuge in her human heart. Although she leaned to bear the human load, her walk still kept the measure of the gods, to wrestle with the shadow she had come and must confront the riddle of man's birth and life's brief struggle in dumb matter's night. A world's desire compelled her mortal birth. Princess Savitri's father was King Ashwapati, a great universalized being. He was also a yogi, and in the story of his yoga, he journeyed through all the planes and parts of being to reach the center and starting point of creation, searching for the Divine Mother, to ask her to help suffering humanity. He aspired for all, and he worked for all. Although consenting to mortal ignorance, his knowledge shared the light ineffable, a strength of the original permanence entangled in the moment and its flow. He kept the vision of the vasts behind. A power was on him from the unknowable. His days were a long growth to the supreme. He gazed across the empty stillnesses and heard the footsteps of the undreamed idea in the far avenues of the beyond. He plunged his roots into the infinite. He based his life upon eternity. There came his soul's release from ignorance, his mind and body's first spiritual change. Apart he lived, in his mind's solitude, a demigod, shaping the lives of men. One soul's ambition lifted up the race. A power worked, but none knew whence it came. His walk through time outstripped the human stride. Lonely his days, and splendid like the sun's. A will, a hope immense now seized his heart, and to discern the superhuman's form, he raised his eyes to unseen spiritual heights, aspiring to bring down a greater world. One pointed to the immaculate delight, questing for God, as for a splendid prey, he mounted, burning like a cone of fire. A voyager upon uncharted routes, fronting the viewless danger of the unknown, adventuring across enormous realms, he broke into another space and time. And so, the traveler of the worlds, King Ashwapati, climbed the world stair in his search for truth. Alone he moved, watched by the infinity around him and the unknowable above. A seer within, who knows the ordered plan concealed behind our momentary steps, inspires our ascent to viewless heights, as once the abysmal leap to birth and life. His call had reached the traveler in time. Apart, in an unfathomed loneliness, he traveled in his mute and single strength, bearing the burden of the world's desire. No term was fixed to the high-pitched attempt. World after world disclosed its guarded powers, heaven after heaven, its deep beatitudes. But still, the invisible magnet drew his soul. A figure soul on nature's giant stair, he mounted towards an indiscernible end, on the bare summit of created things. As the king traveled through inner space, he came first to the kingdoms of subtle matter. The beautiful things of the gross material world come from this kingdom, and when its fine subtle substance becomes more and more gross, dense matter arises. Ashwapati traveled through that fine material paradise, but he was looking for a greater light, so he moved on deeper and deeper, higher and higher, seeking the truth of the manifestation. His destiny lay beyond, in larger space. He traveled through the regions of the glory and fall of life, and he found that he was incapable of entering the region of bliss and all the goodness that life had to give. This world of bliss he saw and felt its call, but found no way to enter into its joy. Across the conscious gulf there was no bridge. A darker air still encircled his soul. Although he had once felt the eternal's clasp, too near to suffering worlds his nature lived, and where he stood were entrances of night. To learn why he could not enter, Ashwapati followed life through its changes as it enters into matter and assumes a mask of death and pain. Seeking great answers, the great king followed life's pace through her slow ascension as a blind force compels life to seek and feel. He moved through the kingdoms and godheads of the little life and saw the first beginnings of mind. He saw life governed by the small ego. He saw a little life turned in upon itself. But in some part of his being, he remained aware of the presence and working of the divine power always. Still, he could not find the answers here. So Ashwapati moved through the kingdom and godheads of the greater life. In this kingdom, some rays of spiritual light were beginning to bring growth towards higher ways of being. Life moved towards release into higher things. But he saw that life was still caught by death and darkness. A mind absolved from life, made calm to know. A heart divorced from the blindness and the pang, the seal of tears, the bond of ignorance. He turned to find that wide world failure's cause. Away he looked from nature's visible face and set his gaze into the viewless vast. The veil was rent that covers nature's depths. He saw the fount of the world's lasting pain and the mouth of the black pit of ignorance. The evil guarded at the roots of life raised up its head and looked into his eyes. Thus King Aswapati began his descent into night. He saw a fatal influence and a hostile and perverting mind at work, corrupting life. He saw the soul's native will for joy and truth and light overcast with error and grief and pain. He saw life covered over with pain and death. Aware of some dark wisdom still withheld, that was the seal and warrant of this strength, he followed the track of dim, tremendous steps, returning to the night from which they came. The great king traveled down through perilous spaces, ever entering into worse darkness and greater reigns of evil. Him the heights missioned, him the abyss desired. None stood in his way, no voice forbade, for swift and easy is the downward path. A lone discoverer in these menacing realms, guarded like termite cities from the sun, oppressed mid crowd and tramp and noise and flame, passing from dusk to deeper dangerous dusk, he wrestled with powers that snatched from mind its light and smote from him their clinging influences. Aswapati traveled through night and through the world of falsehood where there was no light, no truth, no spirit, no divine. In a world where neither hope nor joy could come, the ordeal he suffered of evil's absolute reign, yet kept intact his spirit's radiant truth. When Aswapati finally stood on the last locked floor of the subconscious, he saw the future awaiting its hour, and he saw the secret key of nature's change. He saw in night the eternal's shadowy veil, new death for a seller of the house of life. In destruction felt creation's hasty pace. New loss is the price of a celestial gain, and hell as a shortcut to heaven's gates. Healed were all things that time's heart had made, and sorrow could live no more in nature's breast. Division ceased to be, for God was there. The mind lit the conscious body with its ray. Matter and spirit mingled and were one. Then the great king found himself in the paradise of the life gods. He was healed and cleansed, and he was ready to move on in his search. The great king entered into the kingdoms and godheads of the little mind, following mind's first forward steps. He saw her different procedures of rigid-bound thought, rash guesswork, reason. On through this, he traveled into the kingdoms and godheads of the greater mind. In these kingdoms, he saw that from the higher realms in the creation, light comes down into the more developed mind. A breath of unattained divinity visits the imperfect earth on which we toil. Across a gleaming ether's golden laugh, a light falls on our vexed, unsatisfied lives. A thought comes down from the ideal worlds and moves us to new model even here, some image of their greatness and appeal and wonder beyond the ken of mortal hope. A faith in things that are not and must be lives, comrade of this world's delight and pain. Ashwapati made his way through a triple realm of ordered thought, where immortal, mighty, and divine thoughts are available to mind. Ascending in this realm, he found a great all-ruling consciousness is there, and mind unwitting serves a higher power. It is a channel, not the source of all. Yet this world did not have the answer. Always the ideal beckoned from afar, awakened by the touch of the unseen, deserting the boundary of things achieved, aspired the strong discoverer tireless thought, revealing at each step a luminous world. He, through the ideal's kingdoms moved at will, accepted their beauty, and their greatness bore, partook of the glories of their wonder fields, but passed nor stayed beneath their splendor's rule. All there was an intense but partial light. Then the great traveler moved into the self of mind, where he realized that nothing could be known, that he must reach the source from which all knowledge comes. An answer to his seeking came, and he followed the way to the center of creation, into the world soul. The silent soul of all the world was there. A being lived, a presence and a power, a single person who was himself and all, and cherished nature's sweet and dangerous throbs, transfigured into beats divine and pure. His soul passed on, a single conscious power, towards the end which ever begins again. Approaching through a stillness dumb and calm to the source of all things human and divine, there he beheld, in their mighty union's poise, the figure of the deathless two in one, a single being in two bodies clasped, a diarchy of two united souls, seated, absorbed in deep creative joy. Their trance of bliss sustained the mobile world. Behind them, in a morning dusk, one stood who brought them forth from the unknowable. The great traveler of the worlds had reached his goal. Standing before him was the Divine Mother. Ever disguised, she awaits the seeking spirit. Watcher on the supreme unreachable peaks, guide of the traveler of the unseen paths, she guards the approach to the alone. The sole omnipotent goddess, ever veiled, of whom the world is an inscrutable mask. The ages are the footfalls of her tread, their happenings the figure of her thoughts. And all creation is her endless act. His spirit was made a vessel of her force, mute in the fathomless passion of his will. He outstretched to her his folded hands of prayer. In response, the Divine Mother half parted the eternal veil. Drunk with a deep golden spiritual wine, he cast from the rent stillness of his soul a cry of adoration and desire, and the surrender of his boundless mind, and the self-giving of his silent heart. He fell down at her feet, unconscious, prone. Now the great king was able to enter into the kingdoms of the greater knowledge. A light was round him, wide and absolute, a diamond purity of eternal sight. Here came the thought that passes beyond thought. Here the still voice, which our listening cannot hear, the knowledge by which the knower is the known, the love in which the beloved and lover are one. He passed to fields of puissance and of calm, and saw the powers that stand above the world. There, knowledge called him to her mystic peaks. His self's infinities began to emerge. The primal energy took him in its arms. His brain was wrapped in overwhelming light. An all-embracing knowledge seized his heart. He linked creation to the eternal sphere. His finite parts approached their absolutes. His actions framed the movements of the gods. His will took up the reins of cosmic force. After this experience, the great king longed to have more, to continue his pursuit of the unknowable, to find the Divine Mother. The presence was lost by which all things have their charm, the glory lacked of which they are dim signs. The world lived on, made empty of its cause, like love when the beloved's face is gone. A silence settled on his striving heart. Absolved from the voice of the world's desire, he turned to the ineffable's timeless call. On a dizzy verge where all disguise must fail, and human mind must abdicate in light, or die like a moth in the naked blaze of truth, he stood, compelled to make a tremendous choice. All he had been, and all towards which he grew, must now be left behind, or else transform into a self of that which has no name. The separate self must melt, or be reborn into a truth beyond the mind's appeal, a stark, companionless reality answered at last to his soul's passionate search, the one by whom all live, who lives by none, an immeasurable luminous secrecy, guarded by the veils of the unmanifest, above the changing cosmic interlude, abode supreme, immutably the same, a silent cause, occult, impenetrable, infinite, eternal, unthinkable, alone. Even while he stood on being's naked edge, and all the passion and seeking of his soul faced their extinction in some featureless vast, the presence he yearned for suddenly drew close. The power, the light, the bliss no word can speak, imaged itself in a surprising beam and built a golden passage to his heart, touching through him all longing sentient beings. The hidden word was found, the long-sought clue. Revealed was the meaning of his spirit's birth, a burning love. From white spiritual founts, annulled the sorrow of the ignorant depths. Suffering was lost in her immortal smile. His spirit was caught in her intolerant flame. Once seen, his heart acknowledged only her. Only a hunger of infinite bliss was left. All aims in her were lost, then found in her. His base was gathered to one pointing spire. But now, his being was too wide for self. His heart's demand had grown immeasurable. His single freedom could not satisfy. Her light, her bliss, he asked for earth and men. Now other claims had hushed in him their cry. Only he longed to draw her presence and power into his heart and mind and breathing frame. Only he yearned to call forever down her healing touch of love and truth and joy into the darkness of the suffering world. His soul was freed and given to her alone. A mightier task remained than all he had done. Patient he sat, like an incarnate hope, motionless on a pedestal of prayer. a strength he sought that was not yet on earth, help from a power too great for mortal will, the light of a truth now only seen afar, a sanction from his high, omnipotent source. He felt the stark resistance, huge and dumb, of our inconscient and unseeing base, the ignorant no in the origin of things. A veiled collaboration with the night even in himself survived and hid from his view. The great king searched his being with fire to find the element in him betraying God. Then, lest a human cry should spoil the truth, he tore desire up from its bleeding roots and offered to the gods the vacant place. Thus, he could bear the touch immaculate. A last and mightiest transformation came. His soul was all in front, like a great sea, flooding the mind and body with its waves. His being spread to embrace the universe, united the within and without, to make of life a cosmic harmony, an empire of the immanent divine. His nature grew a movement of the all, exploring itself to find that all was he. He stood fulfilled on the world's highest line, awaiting the ascent beyond the world, awaiting the descent, the world to save. Infinity swallowed him into shoreless trance. Transgressing the dream shores of conscious mind, he reached at last his semi-paternal base. Apart, at peace above creation's stir, immersed in the eternal altitudes, he abode defended in his shoreless self, companioned only by the all-seeing one. Then suddenly there came a downward look, as if a sea exploring its own depths. A living oneness widened at its core and joined him to unnumbered multitudes. A new and marvelous creation rose. There were no contraries, no sundered parts. All by spiritual links were joined to all and bound indissolubly to the One. The King had reached the new world, the house of the Spirit and the new creation, and he aspired still more to be in the presence of the Divine Mother. Two beings he was, one wide and free above, one struggling, bound, intense, its portion here. A tie between them still could bridge two worlds. His heart lay somewhere conscious and alone, far down below him, like a lamp in night. This only knew there was a truth beyond. This was the fiery point that called her now. It sent its voiceless prayer to the unknown. It listened to the footsteps of its hopes returning through the void immensities. It waited for the fiat of the word that comes through the still self from the Supreme. Then, suddenly, there rose a sacred stir amid the lifeless silence of the void. In a solitude and an immensity, a sound came quivering like a loved footfall heard in the listening spaces of the soul. A touch perturbed his fibers with delight. A boundless heart was near his longing heart. A mystic form enveloped his earthly shape. Intoxicated as with nectarous rain, his nature's passioning stretches flowed to her, flashing with lightnings, mad with luminous wine. His body's cells awoke to spirit sense. Even lost in slumber, mute, inanimate, his very body answered to her power. The one he worshipped was within him now, flame pure, ethereal tressed. A face appeared, and lips moved by immortal words. A shape was seen on threshold mind, a voice absolute and wise, in the heart's chamber spoke. O son of strength, who climb'st creation's peaks, no soul is thy companion in the light. What thou hast won is thine, but ask no more. Man is too weak to bear the infinite's weight. Truth born too soon might break the imperfect earth. Above blind fate and the antagonist powers, moveless there stands a high unchanging will. To its omnipotence leave thy work's result. All things shall change in God's transfiguring hour. But Ashwapati's heart replied to her, a cry amid the silence of the vasts. How shall I rest content with mortal days and the dull measure of terrestrial things? I, who have seen behind the cosmic mask the glory and the beauty of thy face. Hard is the doom to which thou bindest thy sons. I saw the omnipotent's flaming pioneers come crowding down the amber stairs of birth, forerunners of a divine multitude. Out of the path of the morning star they came into the little room of mortal life. Their tread one day shall change the suffering earth and justify the light on nature's face. Although fate lingers in the high beyond, and the work seems vain on which our heart's force was spent, all shall be done for which our pain was born. Even as of old man came behind the beast, this high divine successor surely shall come. Heavy, unchanged, weighs still the imperfect world. The splendid youth of time has passed and failed. O bliss, whoever dwellest deep within, incarnate the white passion of thy force. Mission to earth some living form of thee. Let a great word be spoken from the heights, and one great act unlock the doors of fate. But there arose a wide consenting voice. O strong forerunner, I have heard thy cry. One shall descend and break the iron law, change nature's doom by the lone spirit's power. Beauty shall walk celestial on the earth. Delight shall sleep in the cloud net of her hair, and in her body, as on his homing tree, immortal love shall beat his glorious wings. Nature shall overleap her mortal step. Fate shall be changed by an unchanging will. As a flame disappears in endless light, vanished the splendor and was stilled the word. Her form retreated from the longing earth. His soul drew back into the speed and noise of the vast business of created things. Once more he moved amid material scenes. The eternal seeker in the aeonic field, besieged by the intolerant press of the hours, again was strong for great swift-footed deeds. A god in the figure of the arisen beast, he raised his brow of conquest to the heavens, establishing the empire of the soul on matter and its bounded universe as on a solid rock in infinite seas. The Lord of Life resumed his mighty rounds in the scant field of the ambiguous globe.